Welcome to a new episode of American Hauntings that is about to get really weird. The next two episodes are shows that I've been waiting to do, and they'll both be hosted and produced by Cody Beck and written and performed by Troy Taylor, which is me. This will be the first of two Holly Weird episodes of the season, which of course still has a ways to go. But for 15 episodes, we've been taking you behind the locked doors and down the dirty back alleys of Hollywood, the movie capital of the world, a place that's supposed to be all about palm trees, swimming pools, and movie stars. But if you've wanted murder, myths, cranks, kooks, lunatics, and killers, we've had that too, in spades. And for this show and the next, well, I think kooks and lunatics are going to be sort of taking things over. But if you want to know how we got to this place, I'd suggest going back to the start of the season, which began with episode 70. I won't even pretend to know where it's going to end, but it's going to be a bumpy ride to get there. And with that said, remember that the episodes in the season are definitely not suitable for all listeners. If you continue on from here, well, there's no turning back. So put on your choir robe, shake your tambourine, handle a snake or two, and get ready for the weirdest episode of American Hauntings so far. At some point around 1510, a Spanish mystic and writer named Garcia Rodriguez de Montalvo wrote about a man named Amadis of Gaul and his wanderings and exploits on an island called California, which was located somewhere, quote, west of the Indies. He described it as a paradise on earth, a place where gold lay on the ground for the taking, fruit grew from every tree, and women far outnumbered the men. Well, this story, not surprisingly, motivated many Spanish explorers, including Hernando Cortes, to seek out these magical lands in the West. They were seeking paradise, just like the millions of others who followed in their footsteps over the century. And those footsteps led to California. When you hear the word cult, do you imagine a group of beautiful young people dancing trance-like in the sunshine? Do you assume that a lot of them are aspiring actors who lost their compasses, took a wrong turn at the beach, and wound up in an orgy? Well, if you do think that, you're not alone. The idea has been burned into our collective subconscious. When the public thinks of cults, it thinks of LA and Southern California. I mean, some of the most famous ones in American history have called Southern California home. The Children of God, Heaven's Gate, the People's Temple, the Manson family, and depending on who's defining the word cult, Scientology. While experts will tell you that terrifying and destructive cults can be anywhere, there's a strong connection between Southern California and cults. But not because Southern Californians want what cults offer. Instead, they're systematically and aggressively targeted for recruitment because cults badly want what Southern California offers. Historically, if you wanted to sell something new to a bunch of rich people, you went to California. By the early 20th century, the gold rush and Hollywood had made the state synonymous with cash. And while the East Coast was dominated by established European religions, California in the early days was largely church-free. This made the area appealing to the founders of new religious movements and cults. California became a target for con artists starting movements that were less about religion and more about coercing their followers into giving them money and sex. And if you want to steal even more money, you need a stronger recruitment tactic, which means celebrities, which by the early 1900s, Los Angeles already had plenty of. Recruiting from the Hollywood community and targeting the wealthy people associated with it became such a foolproof plan that cults often opened branches in LA after starting somewhere else. I mean, Heaven's Gate started in New Mexico while Jim Jones began the People's Temple in Indiana, but both of them eventually moved their operations to California. Southern California earned its reputation as a haven for paradise seekers, and it witnessed a tidal wave of cults and communes in the early days of Hollywood, more than anywhere else in the world, in fact, eventually creating one of the strangest collections of people in history. In the early 1900s, Los Angeles and Hollywood became a favorite topic for preachers' sermons across the country. They were the modern American version of Sodom and Gomorrah, those two biblical cities destroyed by God because they had been so wicked. But such descriptions backfired. This became a draw for people in the 1920s, that great period of excess, abandonment, and experimentation. This was the time of the lost generation of young adults who had been traumatized by the horrors of the Great War and who had become cynical about the values of their parents and grandparents, the people responsible for starting that terrible war in the first place. Well, people came to Southern California looking for a new life. Believing that the old traditions and values had failed them, they sought liberation from what they had been taught and now wanted something new. They came west to the place where the new motion picture industry was busy showing people that magic was possible, and they became easy prey for the cults, kooks, and fanatics of the fringe element who followed them to the land of sunshine. The film stars of the 1920s immersed themselves in the occult, paving the way for the seekers that followed in their wake. According to a newspaper reporter that visited one of the studios, quote, "Hundreds of performers are more than passingly interested in necromancy, superstition, and prognostication in general." He noted that seers, palmists, crystal gazers, and trance mediums were everywhere. Many actors, he claimed, paid annual fees to astrologers so they could be kept informed of any planetary changes that might affect their careers. Dr. Lewis Brown, a religious scholar who lived in Santa Monica, noted in 1929 that, quote, "The world is full of primitive minds." He'd been asked to explain why men and women of the era were so easily drawn to unorthodox pagan and primitive religious practices. Brown found the region to be a fruitful field for his studies of religious movements, and he estimated there were at least 400 cults active in Southern California in the late 1920s, with memberships numbering in the hundreds of thousands. They included, he said, notable groups like Seralda and Omar's Love Cult, also known as the Sacred Schools Cult, the Mazdazan Cult, the Magi Cult, and the Christian Church of Psychophagy, whatever that is. According to novelist Nathaniel West, who used the dark side of LA for atmosphere in several of his books and stories, some of the local cults included the Church Invisible, where fortunes were told, the Tabernacle of the Third Coming, where a woman in male clothing preached the crusade against salt, yes, salt, and the Temple Modern, where brain breathing, the secret of the Aztecs, was taught. There were once so many cults in the city that a 1930 newspaper editorial complained that, quote, "Los Angeles extends a welcome asylum to every cult of every kind that seeks to hide temporarily its ugly head until it can build sufficient strength to begin the spreading of its poisonous propaganda. The number of cults in Los Angeles are a standing joke the country over." And well, as you'll see, it's a reputation it kind of deserved. Decades before the hippie movement made free love an international phenomenon, love cults flourished all over Southern California. The first word of them appeared in the early 1920s and began making news a few years later, like one Nest of Love on Santee Street, where women were forced to, quote, "speak in tongues, perform devil dances, and engage in soul mating with spiritual husbands." Another love cult, Helios, was the creation of Edith Lessing, who presided over a ramshackle compound of tents and shacks in Glassell Park, which she had renamed Mount Helios. Edith declared free love would replace marriage, believed in communal ownership of property, and boasted that she had control over more than 1,000 men. She was imprisoned in 1922 for sending obscene materials through the mail. In 1939, the High Priestess Regina Cool captured the attention of the authorities when she was caught indoctrinating male students at LA City College with her Temple of Thelma. The temple was set up in the basement of one of the dorms, and there she would don robes, chant some suggestive passages from an Aleister Crowley book, and quote, "embrace the power of the lifted lance." I'll let you decide what she meant by the lifted lance. In 1946, Henry King Daddy Newsom was arrested for running his own sex camp called Ten Oaks. According to newspaper reports, he molested 16 underage girls over the course of 2 years. In his defense, he claimed that he was teaching them the beauty of sexual intercourse. Several of the girls claimed that he controlled their minds through hypnosis. Guy Ballard started the I Am movement after arriving in LA during the Great Depression. His claim? That during a hike on Mount Shasta, he met a stranger named Saint Germain who wore a bejeweled robe and gave him the power to create wealth and energy. He had more than a million followers, and his books about Saint Germain were bestsellers, hence the creation of wealth for himself anyway. Purification by fire and Garden of Eden orgies were part of the activities of the House of Judah cult. Members prayed and chanted together in the nude and sacrificed lambs, which they burned alive, much to the horror of their neighbors. Bishop Wilbur Leroy Casper was arrested in 1926 and sentenced to 6 months in jail for violations of practicing medicine mixed with religion without a license. His cult, who gathered to wait for him outside the jail, were, quote, lightly clad dancers, major and minor deities, a scattering of archangels, and scores of uncostumed followers, mostly women. Well, they promised onlookers a resurrection day to celebrate their leader's eventual release. Margaret Rowan founded the Seventh-day Adventist mission, not to be confused with the Seventh-day Adventist Church, and was adamant that the world would end on February 6, 1925. She drew an estimated 1,000 followers and a lot of publicity, but it turned out she was more successful as a self-promoter than as a prophet, as everyone in LA discovered on February 7th. However, she did claim that one of her children was born as a result of, quote, delvings in the occult, mysterious experiments in mind control, and spiritual investigations, while she and her husband were members of the cult. Well, I should note that at the time of that interview, her husband was a patient at a state mental hospital, so you can judge for that however you'd like. Foreshadowing Scientology, a religion based on pulp writings by a science fiction author, was Mankind United, which was created by another science fiction writer named Arthur Bell. During the Depression, Bell wrote a book called Mankind United, a repetitive and pretty much awful volume filled with bold type and large blocks of capitalized text. It told the story of a malevolent conspiracy that ran the world, the hidden rulers and the money changers, who were not only responsible for war, poverty, and injustice, but who were also, wait for it, aliens living on the Earth. Opposing them, though, was another group of aliens, the Sponsors, who had arrived on Earth in 1875. According to Bell, the benevolent Sponsors were shortly going to announce their presence and would put in place a worldwide utopia based on universal employment and a financial system based on credits. The workday would be for only 4 hours a day, 4 days a week. Well, needless to say, this sounded pretty good to the tired, worn-out people who were struggling to put food on their tables. Well, in order for the Sponsors to put their plan into place, they had to receive massive support from the people. The plan would be promoted by the, quote, Pacific Coast Division of North America International Registration Bureau, which was, of course, run by Arthur Bell. He announced that when 200 million people accepted the Mankind United plan, the Sponsors would overthrow their rival alien groups, and within 30 days, the new utopia would begin. Of course, there were no Sponsors, no evil aliens, and no international bureau. The whole thing had been concocted by Bell, and it never numbered more than a few thousand followers. The only beneficiary of the group was Bell, who had several luxurious apartments and mansions, including a swanky place on the Sunset Strip that had an indoor pool, a pipe organ, and a cocktail bar. Bell was spotted in all of the hottest nightclubs, freely spending the tax-free $50,000 he was making each year. His followers, on the other hand, worked in various cult businesses full-time, including hotels and shops. They were paid less than $40 a month and worked up to 16 hours a day, 7 days a week, which was quite a bit more than the utopian work week that had been promised in Bell's book. Well, the cult gained the attention of the authorities during World War II. Bell incorporated as a church, which he called the Church of the Golden Rule, to obtain tax exemption and began making even more bizarre claims, such as the idea that he could be beamed to several different places at once and that the Sponsors had advanced technology that allowed the dead to be resurrected on other planets. You'll be shocked to learn none of that was true either. The cult folded and faded away in 1951. In the 1950s, George King started the Atherius Society. He claimed he was in his apartment when an alien spoke to him and shared transmissions from an all-star cosmic dream team that included Jesus and Buddha. Setting up his headquarters in Hollywood, he gained a healthy following, promising to save the world using radionic energy that he gathered from Mount Baldy. A self-described clairvoyant and prophet, Southern-born Anne Rhee Colton blended Christianity with metaphysics and dream analysis to create what she called nigh science. In 1966, she built a compound in Glendale where visitors can hear recordings of her lectures on reincarnation, past lives, and ESP. Colton claimed to have once been a maiden in Atlantis. She died in 1884, and well, I don't know who she became the next time around, but her husband and co-founder hanged himself in 1991 after a lot of accusations came out that they had fleeced their followers. Well, the source wasn't just a Sunset Strip health food cafe. It was also Father Yode's tribal community of more than 100 white-robed seekers who moved into a Los Feliz mansion in 1972. Some jammed in his rock band called Yahoo-Wah 13 and collected money for him. The cops called Yode, quote, part guru, part father, part pimp. He died in a hang gliding accident in 1975. Well, things started to get pretty dark in Hollywood and across the country in the late 1960s. A surge of interest in the occult swept the nation, especially after the Hollywood film Rosemary's Baby. But sinister cults had already been around in Hollywood for a while. There had been devil-worshipping cults in California long before Anton LaVey founded the Church of Satan in California in 1969. Well, the Church of Satan doesn't actually worship Satan, but that's going to get us way off track, so let's just stick to L.A. A man named Makio Temin was murdered in Oakland in 1926. In his home, the police found books and manuals on the occult and prayers signed in blood. They also found a drawing of a cross at the base of a tree surrounded by hills with an eerie sun floating above them and cryptic symbols surrounding everything. The prayer written in blood began, "Most Powerful Lucifer," and it asked for wisdom and strength to overcome his enemies, but guessing that didn't work out for him. In 1930, a woman under police protection told newspaper reporters that she was so terrified of a devil cult she'd abandoned that she was afraid to say its name. Well, it was later discovered to be called Hickory Hall, which honestly doesn't really sound that scary, but there it is. The woman who was the priestess for the group, Mrs. Leach, dominated, and this is a quote, dominated the household mentally and physically. We could have no wills of our own, no thoughts except hers. When the former member had objected to cult children being spanked with sticks, she was bent over a chair and spanked by five cult members in retaliation. I gotta tell you, sometimes people pay good money for that kind of thing, but I'm gonna guess it wasn't working out for her. She later received a telegram from her former fellow cult members with a four-word message that only said, quote, "We won't hurt you." Okay. Another cult with a sinister reputation was the Process Church of the Final Judgment, which began to flourish in the 1960s and 70s. Its founders were an Englishman named Robert Moore, who later changed his name to Robert de Grimston, because I guess that sounded cooler, and Marianne McLean. It began as a splinter cult group from Scientology, and Moore and McLean were declared suppressive persons by L. Ron Hubbard in December 1965 and were kicked out of Scientology. Now, imagine how crazy you have to be for that to happen. Anyway, after bouncing around Mexico, they came back to LA and started the Process Church. Their peculiar theology stated that Jehovah, Christ, and Satan were not enemies, but all equal parts of creation. Satan had apparently patched things up with Jesus, and together they were going to show up at the end of the world and judge humanity. Jesus would separate the bad from the good, and Satan would bring down the final curtain on the earth. Like most cults, they recruited teenagers and young people, separating them from their friends and family, and indoctrinating them into the group. De Grimston, who became known as the Teacher, and McLean, who became known as the Oracle, just had to keep everyone in line while they waited for the end of the world. The world didn't come to an end, but the 1960s did, and the Manson family murders were a big part of the reason the era of peace, love, and understanding came to a grinding halt. And yes, we'll be talking about Charlie and the Girls very soon. A lot of writers would like to link Manson to the Process Church, but how much of that is true and how much was Charlie's usual bullshit is unknown. Regardless, by the early 1970s, the church was starting to fall apart. the cult started to get darker, a lot darker. They started wearing black robes, practicing animal sacrifices, and started using a swastika as an insignia. De Grimston was essentially turning the cult into Hollywood's version of devil worshipers, right out of the movie Race with the Devil. In addition, his increasing fascination with group sex and the importance of Satan in his writings alienated many members of the process church. And besides that, Satan kind of made fundraising a little difficult. Anyway, De Grimston was ousted from his own church in 1974, and a new group rose from the ashes called the Foundation Faith of the Millennium. The founders kept things going until the late 1970s, but by then, well, they were a little more than a newsletter. The David Son of Sam Berkowitz slayings of 1977 didn't help the splinter group, as both the process and a supposed satanic fringe group were implicated in the murders. This conspiracy theory was promoted by a book called The Ultimate Evil by Maury Terry, which was released at the height of the Satanic Panic movement in 1987. But there is no hard evidence the process had anything to do with Berkowitz or the Son of Sam murders, outside of Berkowitz's own confused and contradictory testimony. Remember, this is a guy who said he took directions from a dog. Anyway, for some reason, conspiracy buffs refuse to let this one go, as evidenced by the recent Netflix documentary. Just remember, though, that not everything you see on TV is true. As for Robert De Grimston, he tried to get the Process Church up and running again several times in the years that followed, but he can never replicate his initial success. For now, the Process Church of the Final Judgment remains a thing of the past. But not every sect that has its roots in Southern California had something sinister in the background. But there weren't very many of those, especially those that catered to the rich and famous that gained fame and fortune without some kind of scandal. The 1930s brought the Great Depression and a mass exodus of what were called Okies from the Dust Bowl region, hoping to make a new life in sunny California. No one knows how many of these people came west, hoping to find the glittering promise of the region, but the impact of these new arrivals, who were mostly poor white Protestants, was tremendous. A new wave of churches, cults, and sects sprang up in response. Simple, welcoming, and often fire and brimstone in theology, the new sects, along with the traditional churches of charismatic fervor, attracted huge followings. And a lot of them brought racism and white supremacy to the masses right along with God. Bob Schuller, or Fighting Bob as he became known, was a preacher from Virginia who arrived in Hollywood in 1920. He took over the congregation of a failing Methodist church in downtown LA and soon began offering attention-getting sermons that blamed everyone but his poor congregation for their problems. His message began to spread, appealing to the Okies, and soon his church attendance had increased to almost $3,000. Like many preachers at the time, he hated Catholics, Jews, Hollywood, movies, and the theory of evolution. He was also, again not surprisingly, a supporter of the Ku Klux Klan, which believed that it was necessary for white Protestant men to preserve their heritage, usually violently. Anyway, in 1926, a member of Schuller's congregation gave him his own radio station as a present, which started him on the road to becoming America's first broadcast evangelist. He began spreading his message to greater audiences, but it was not long before he went too far. He started attacking LA city officials, claiming the mayor was corrupt, the police chief was spying on him, the city council was letting Hollywood Jews put pornography in the movie houses, and the newspapers were conspiring against him by printing fake news. In 1929, Schuller spent 15 days in jail for claiming on his radio station that theater owner Alexander Pantages and his wife were going to bribe the juries in their upcoming trials. Pantages had been accused of raping a showgirl named Eunice Pringle, and his wife had been charged with drunk driving and manslaughter. I mean, it's Hollywood. That's like, I think you have to do those things. Anyway, later that year, a Schuller congregation member and Klan supporter, John Porter, became mayor. And for a time, Fighting Bob could do and say just about anything he wanted. In 1932, Schuller ran for U.S. Senate on the Prohibition ticket. After losing an earlier political run, Shuler had placed a curse on the entire state and then took credit for several subsequent earthquakes that happened in LA. His predictions of dire catastrophes if he lost again were not enough to sway the voters, though. He came in second to Woodrow Wilson's son-in-law, William McAdoo. Shuler's popularity began to fade, and newspaper magnate William Randolph Hearst finally did something decent and made Shuler his personal hobby. He reportedly spent $1 million in efforts to destroy Shuler's ministry. It wasn't long before the FCC took his radio license away from him, calling Shuler a public menace. A magazine that he edited promoting white supremacy in the Klan folded in 1933. After thousands of new war industry jobs arrived in LA in the early 1940s, Shuler's ministry base, the poor and unemployed, declined. Shuler died in 1965, a forgotten relic of a stranger time. But while Fighting Bob Shuler was stirring up the Okies with his fiery sermons and cries for white supremacy, another evangelist was presenting a kinder, gentler message. She did it with flamboyant presentations that were right out of a Hollywood musical, and in fact, the regular appearance of movie stars at her services was one of her claims to fame. The evangelist's name was Amy Semple McPherson, and the Pentecostal church that she founded, the International Church of the Four Square Gospel, still exists today. Sister Amy, as her thousands of followers called her, was born Amy Kennedy and raised on a farm in Ontario, Canada. Growing up, she followed in her grandfather's footsteps by joining the Salvation Army. But after a crisis of faith, she was converted to Pentecostalism by an evangelist named Robert Semple. She first joined his church and traveled with him preaching revivals around the country and then married him in 1908. 2 years later, while they were awaiting their papers to travel into China as missionaries, Semple died in Hong Kong. Amy, now with an infant daughter, returned to the U.S. and married a second time in 1912 to a grocery salesman named Harold McPherson and gave birth to a son. Amy tried to settle down to the quiet life of a housewife, but she was unable to do it. She felt she was destined for bigger things. She divorced McPherson in 1918, and she, her children, and her mother, Minnie, with nothing more than $100 and a tambourine, as she liked to tell it, drove to Los Angeles. It was a trip that Amy later referred to as a spiritual quest that ended in revelation. She believed that the City of Angels was the doorway to heaven, and for a time, it certainly seemed to be. She began spreading her message in every way possible, even throwing tracts from an airplane as it flew over neighborhoods populated by recent arrivals to the city. She was soon packing standing room only crowds into the Philharmonic Auditorium, which was then the largest venue in LA. By 1923, she had her own Angelus Temple, which seated 5,300 people and cost more than $1.5 million to build. At her services, she entertained the curious and the faithful alike with bizarre stage sketches that featured a USC football player making a touchdown for Jesus and an LAPD motorcycle cop riding in to arrest sin. Well, everyone loved the show, and soon her popularity would rival that of some movie stars. Besides entertaining and preaching, Amy was also an avid organizer. She added some 250 affiliated churches, a rescue mission, a publications division, an orchestra, and a radio station, creating a massive organization that is only rivaled by today's mega churches. She also composed 180 hymns and several musical pageants, all of which were very upbeat and offered redemption. In keeping with her Salvation Army background, she also designed uniforms for herself and for her female bodyguards. Not surprisingly, Amy had a talent for raising money, which supported the church, her mansion near MGM Studios in Culver City, her expensive clothes, and a fine automobile. At collection time, she would often tell her supporters from the stage, quote, "Sister has a headache tonight. Only quiet money, please." Well, as the money rolled in, stories of miraculous cures began to spread. A miracle room in the Angelus Temple was filled with discarded crutches, wheelchairs, and even the leg braces of a 10-year-old polio victim. He was so confident when he came to visit Sister Amy that he brought another pair of shoes with him to wear home. The stories claimed he walked out of the temple. Then in 1926, Amy's glory days mostly came to an end. A scandal captured the imagination of readers across America and offered them lurid headlines for weeks afterward. On the afternoon of May 18, 1926, Amy was spotted swimming off Ocean Park Beach in Santa Monica. And then she vanished without a trace. She was presumed to have drowned, but after a massive search, during which a church volunteer and a professional diver drowned, her body was not recovered. A terrible time of mourning followed after Amy was officially presumed dead. An all-day memorial service attended by thousands of weeping and hysterical mourners was held on June 20th. People packed into the church to say their final goodbyes. But, well, let's just say that turned out to be a little premature. 3 days later, Amy herself turned up in the Mexican town of Agua Prieta, claiming that she had been kidnapped and held in a shack in the Sonoran Desert. On her return to Los Angeles, a carpet of roses was spread when she disembarked from the train, and more than 1,000 of her followers and well-wishers lined the streets and cheered as she drove by. But Amy had returned. Things weren't exactly what they appeared to be. It was soon discovered that Amy had actually spent the month at a cottage in Carmel, shacked up with Kenneth Ormiston, a married engineer on the staff of her radio station. For nearly 6 months, L.A. District Attorney Asa Keys gathered evidence, which included a Carmel grocery store shopping list in Amy's handwriting, planning to charge her with conspiracy to produce false testimony. In the end, though, Amy's fame saved her from prosecution. Inexplicably, the DA decided that the case he'd built against her was too weak to bring against a person of her tremendous popularity. On the evening that Keyes made the announcement, the faithful mobbed Amy and the newspapers spread the news in glaring headlines. But the damage was already done. For most of America, Amy had become a dirty joke. Amy Simple McPherson carried on for 20 more years, preaching and defending herself against the old scandal. It never seemed to go away, and in 1930, she suffered a nervous breakdown. She was prescribed Seconal to deal with her anxieties, and on September 27, 1944, she died in San Francisco from an accidental overdose. Some of her closest friends attributed the accident to a combination of a broken heart and exhaustion from her endless struggle to restore her name, her popularity, and her influence. At her funeral, held at the Angelus Temple, more than 40,000 mourners passed by her casket to say goodbye. Again. Except this time, it was real. But I do want to leave you with this, however, just to show that no matter how mainstream Amy's church might have seemed at the time, it still had the kind of kookiness linked to it that you'll only find in L.A. There was a weird rumor that followed Amy to the grave. When she was buried at Forest Lawn Cemetery in a huge tomb with an iron gate guarded by two kneeling marble angels, it was said that a direct telephone line to the Angelus Temple was installed in the tomb with her. That way, when she returned from the dead, as her followers believed she would, she'd be able to alert someone to come to the cemetery and let her out of the tomb. It was a rumor, and I have no idea if that story is true, but, well, if it wasn't, it should have been. So we'll see you back here in 2 weeks with the second part of our Hollywood's Preachers, Cults, Kooks, and Crazies two-parter with the story of the most terrifying and the weirdest cult in LA history. Thanks for listening.
There's one thing that the American Hauntings podcast knows about, and that's mothers. We featured a lot of great mothers in a lot of our episodes. Pearl Curran, Julia Lemp, Sarah Moore, Marie Laveau, Jane Mansfield, Tamsin Donner, Delphine LaLaurie, Belle Gunness. Okay, maybe leave out those last two. But what I'm saying is that with Mother's Day coming soon, you need a truly special gift for your mom because, well, she's not Belle Gunness. So let me tell you about MyLifeInABook.com. It's a unique service that literally turns your mom's life story into a book. So here's how it works. Every week, MyLifeInABook.com will send your mom a question in her email, the same way she sends you questions about your dating life or when you plan to give her grandkids. Anyway, these can be pre-written questions about her life or any custom questions that you want to ask. She replies by either typing in the answers or by recording her own voice. Then MyLifeInABook.com compiles all her responses into a keepsake book, and they can create an audiobook that uses her voice recordings, preserving her voice and her stories forever. As anyone who doesn't have their mom around anymore can tell you, having your mother's stories about growing up, being a kid, and overcoming life's challenges will be something that you and your kids will treasure. And let's be honest, your mom has given you a lifetime of stories. This is your chance to give her a very cool way to share them. Honestly, I decided to try this out for myself, and I sent it to my mom, and she's not exactly a whiz at computers, but she still found it really easy to use. My mom might have had a little more unusual childhood than a lot of mothers do, so I'm really glad to have this, and I think you'll be glad to give one to your mother too. So check out mylifeinabook.com and use the code HAUNTINGS at checkout for 10% off. Create an unforgettable gift for your mom this Mother's Day. That's mylifeinabook.com and use the code HAUNTINGS for 10% off today.
Don't put that on there. Don't leave that in.
It's Mike Tyson's favorite catchphrase.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, boy. Okay. All right. Thanks for tuning into the American Hauntings Podcast, the show where we discuss history, hauntings, legends, lore, and the dark side of American history. We are now in season 5 of the podcast, Haunted Hollywood. I'm your co-host, Cody Beck, and with me is my co-host, author, historian, crime buff, and the founder of American Hauntings, Troy
Orson
Taylor.
Welles.
Orson Welles. I did get some emails about Orson Welles with some outtakes and different fun stuff that people sent us, so I just can't escape that.
No, probably not. Yeah, I know. I don't know. I was going to say I don't know what got that started, but it was all my fault.
Yeah, so. You were what got that started. Like, don't act like you don't fucking know what happened. It broke things up, broke up the monotony a little bit, you know?
Yes,
we like to keep you on your toes here at American Hauntings. So.
Yeah.
Oh, geez. What's been going on, man? What do we got? What's going on in your life?
Well, it's summer.
Yeah.
Now, finally.
It feels like it.
It seems like summer. I know.
I'm hot in here.
Yeah, it finally feels like summer, so which is nice. And things are people are excited about getting out and doing stuff again, which is really nice. So we've had a lot of like sold-out events, lots of sold-out events, including the conference coming up the end of July.
Sure.
So somebody asked me how come we weren't talking about it this year, and I'm like, well... There's nothing to talk about because you can't, if you didn't sign up, you can't come.
Yeah, you can't
stay
with us.
Yeah, you'll have to come the next year. But anyway, with stuff opening back up and, you know, and I'm going to say that is all thanks to people smart enough to get vaccinated, and I'm not going to get into it.
Right.
But, you know, we are doing all the heavy lifting here, the vaccinated people.
Yep.
We're the reason things are open.
Get my second shot on the 12th.
Exactly. Yep. So anyway, I do want to plug a couple of things. I want to plug the Dinner and Spirits events we have coming up. They are, all of them are more than half, well, some are closer to being almost completely full, but all of them are over half full. And those are for, the junior ones are sold out. So July and August events are, that's all we have left. For the summer, as far as our summer schedule goes.
Did you do a Hell Hath No Fury one yet?
I did, but I'm doing another one in August.
How was that?
In August. Good. It was fun.
Yeah. I want to check one of those out.
Yeah. So
I love that dangerous one.
Yeah. That's coming up too. So we do have one of those, but we also have a lot of tours that are finally opening up. Alton in Chicago, especially. So I have a deal just for podcast listeners.
Oh, shit.
You get 10% off any of your tickets for Alton or the Weird Chicago Tours this summer. When you make a reservation, all you have to do is use the promo code HOLIDAY, and you'll get 10% off your tickets no matter how many you buy.
All right. What website
do
they go?
So Alton Hauntings for the Alton Tours and WeirdChicago.com for our Weird Chicago Tours.
And that's promo code HOLIDAY.
HOLIDAY.
Okay, guys, I need Troy to think this podcast helps his business, so please go to the sites, use that promo code, and let's show them that, you know, these listeners, this is more than just for me and my ego.
Okay.
Now, that seems really exciting.
Yeah, so we thought we'd throw that out there just for podcast listeners. You know, we always do have that. You know, and we do remember to mention it sometimes that we, you know, we do offer a discount to podcast listeners off books and stuff just by using the promo code podcast.
Yeah.
You still get 10% off stuff.
Yep.
So
But we also have, as I said, I do have some dinner and spirits things coming up. We have, I think, just one River Road tour left for August 28th for the summer. The other ones are sold out. But we do have a dinner and spirits event. We have the Donner Party on July 3rd. On August 6th, we have the Haunted Hotels. Mm-hmm. August 7th is Wyatt Earp and Ghost Stories of Tombstone.
You can be busy boy that weekend.
Yeah, on the 14th, we've got the Hell Hath No Fury.
Okay.
So anybody who's interested in any of those things, you can find them just by going to AmericanHauntings.net, the main website. Mm-hmm. But then, you know, like I said, on the tour with the coupon, with the 10% off, it's AltonHauntings.com or WeirdChicago.com.
AltonHauntings.com, yeah. WeirdChicago.com. That's awesome. If anybody's interested in doing stuff, especially around Alton, I'm just going to recommend that last River Road tour that you have, because those are some of my favorites.
I really like doing those. So we've got one next weekend, but it's been – somebody asked me the other day, can we get tickets for that? Well, you can if you time travel. You want like 2 months.
Yeah, strap you to the top of the bus.
Yeah, there's just no way to do it, but yeah.
Awesome. Well, I'm super glad to hear that people are coming out and being able to do things.
Yeah, things are picking up.
Yeah, things are picking back up. That's awesome. So let's see. We went on a crazy ride as far as listener reviews for a while there because we were begging for them so we could hit that 1,000.
Yeah.
We hit 1,000 reviews, kept that 5, you know, star rating. And then after that, I was like, I don't care after this. I was done. You guys did exactly what I asked, and it was amazing. We still get a couple reviews coming in after that. So this one is from Lady De Purple. Sorry if I'm supposed to say that with an accent or something, but that's what it says. It's titled Great Pod History and Creepy Interest. It says, just want to thank you for your entertaining and informative show. Love your advice on local and travel tours. Going to LA this year and looking forward to visiting some spots from the recent series. And then a purple heart emoji. Okay, because Lady De Purple. Okay, So thank you so much for that review. That really means a lot to us. A couple random things before we get started. What are your thoughts on the new Evil Dead movie going straight to streaming?
Is it a movie or a series?
I thought it was a movie. I think it's the next one in the movie, but I'm not positive.
Well, it's a wave of the future.
It makes sense, right?
I mean, it does. Because they don't have to worry about the ratings boards and everything. Because I remember when the original came out.
Yeah.
And there was no way they could get that thing. I mean, they were lucky to be able to put it out unrated and still people be able to see it.
Wait, they put it out unrated?
The original. The very first Evil Dead was put out unrated.
What was that, the 87?
No. It was earlier than that. It was like 81, 82.
Oh, shit. Okay.
And it came out unrated.
You could do that back then.
Yeah, you could do that back then, but a lot of newspapers wouldn't run ads. Mm. A lot of theater chains wouldn't carry it, so it took a long time for it to get out there. In fact, it wasn't until Stephen King saw it and said, this is the most original horror film I've seen this year. Go
really?
See it. And then people started getting into, you know, finding it, tracking it down. But then you got to remember, too, that the early 80s were the beginning of the home video movement.
Mm-hmm.
And so people went bananas over stuff on home video.
Right.
And that's, you know, what started. So essentially what you had in the 80s with direct-to-video, now we've got direct-to-streaming. And, I mean, a lot of really great movies came out last year. It's just people didn't see them because they didn't know to look for them.
Right.
And I think we're still going to continue to see a lot of stuff come straight to streaming. And I think that I watched last weekend, Orin and I watched Army of the Dead.
Yeah.
And it was great.
I thought, yeah.
I mean, it was worth just seeing it on Netflix. I didn't have to go to the theater to see that.
Mm-hmm.
But we really liked it. It was just fun.
It was fun.
Silly fun. So, you know, and now they've got it so that when you put something out on Netflix that it can qualify for Academy Awards and stuff like that. So
some people aren't happy about that.
No, I know.
But
I know.
I'm down
it's
for it.
It's fine with me. I like the mixture of stuff. I mean,
yeah.
I went to see Spiral, the new Saw movie.
I haven't seen it. What'd you think?
Yeah, it was okay.
Yeah.
I mean, it wasn't, I wouldn't go, this is the best one I've ever seen or anything like that. But it was still pretty good.
Yeah.
We enjoyed it. I mean, I think I gave it like 3 stars or something.
Yeah.
So it was worth seeing. But, you know, the movie experience is, I mean, the place was mostly deserted.
Say, what was it like being back in a movie theater?
I mean, well, that was my second. That was my second movie back, and I'm going to go see it. I know you saw Quiet Place 2, and
sure.
I'm going to see it, try to see it this weekend at some point.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I got stuff going on, but I'm going to try to see it this weekend. And I liked it. I mean, the theater that we went to see it at was ones with a big leather seats with the recliner your legs that stuff. So, you know, but it was still kind of, you know, I don't know, it was empty. Yeah. We were the only people in there, you know. But, of course, you know me. I do that on purpose. I go I go to see horror films on Sunday morning at 10 a.m. because I know no one will be there.
Same,
or very few people will be there. So,
yeah.
But, yeah, I, you know, I enjoyed it. And so we'll see. You know, we'll just see how things go.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that the theaters are going to be, the stuff they waited on, I know that they had a good opening for Quiet Place 2, but compared to, let's say, 2019, if it had come out, you know, it was
totally
a fraction
different.
Of what, you know, they would have seen. So,
I'm,
but it's also coming out in like 45 days on something else.
Yeah, yeah. On streaming,
is it? Yeah, I saw on streaming, probably so, just for rental, but still.
Yeah, so you know? I went, so I saw Bloodshot last year, and then shit hit the fan.
Yeah.
A Quiet Place 2 was the next movie I was supposed to go see, and then I couldn't. And then eventually I saw Tenet. I was one of four
you
people in the theater,
fall,
which was kind of surreal too. And then I finally got to go back to the theater for A Quiet Place 2 the other day, and I mean, I went to Ronnie's on Lindbergh, and it was I love that theater, and it was still very surreal, but it reminded me like, okay, yes, the streaming is great, and I do love just being able to like the convenience and everything of my home theater kind of thing, but that it reminded me of why every once in a while there's certain movies I want to see in the theater. And I liked that.
Yeah.
You don't see your face is saying you're disagreeing with me.
It's not that.
What do you think?
I love movie theaters. I love movies. I love movies. I love movie theaters. But I've gotten to the point where I'm so sick and tired of the way that people behave in movie theaters that I just as soon stay home.
That's
fair. Plus, I laugh. Plus, I'm an old man, and I like to have the words on. Can we put the words on? You know, and so if there's no caption, I'm like, shit, what did Chris Rock just say? You know, that kind of
captions
thing.
Captions are so, a good point.
I like captions.
That is very fair. So
even though I play everything, like, you know, so
at a
that
billion
the whole
decibels.
Building shakes.
Because you got that great sound system.
I do.
Yeah.
It just shakes the building, but I still like the captions on. Well, because I watched so many, you know, all last summer. Every time you talk to me, oh, yeah, I'm watching a Norwegian crime thriller.
Right.
I have to have captions, even if they're speaking English. I
have
understand them.
I have captions, too. And that actually brings up a good point, and I'm not trying to brag, but all the movies I see are typically press screening, so if you pull out a phone, they kick you out.
Yeah.
So, like,
yeah,
I don't have anybody doing any bullshit
that's
or
nice.
Anything. And I forgot... Yeah, how terrible people
it
can
is,
be in normal screenings.
Yeah, I don't want to hear your candy wrappers. I don't want to hear you talking.
Your commentary.
I don't want to hear any of that. I want to pretend like you're not there.
Yeah, don't be texting
and
take
so
calls.
That's,
and
that's become my issue.
That's totally
theaters.
Fair. Well, that probably lent itself a lot to you building your own like kind of dope ass sound
system. That's why
in
I have all that stuff at home. Yeah.
Oh, man. All right. Well, okay. So I just wanted to take us off on that little tangent for a minute.
Sure. You know, you can start me off on, wind me up on movie stuff.
I know. I think, these are going to be some probably, I don't know if they're going to be longer episodes or not, but we're going to get into some details about some stuff. And I'm excited to talk cult, man. Like, I think everybody that's remotely interested in this stuff is down for cults, but I think even just your average person's probably like has a genuine curiosity.
Yeah, we're all curious about the mindset and you know, and so many people are just, oh, I don't see how they could possibly believe that, and then the stuff they believe is just as crazy.
Uh-huh.
And you know, and I think we're all that way in
of course.
Some ways. You know, we all
human.
Have our weird tangents that we, you know, go off on in our brain, and it's just some people's
can exploit
skew
it
toward religion, and then you have people who will, yes, exploit that.
Yeah.
And that was kind of the point I was trying to make at the beginning of this. We always talk about all the fruits and nuts in California.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the reason that there is because people went out there for one thing, and then, you know, all these cults and churches followed behind them.
Yes.
And, you know,
and
here we are.
So we're going to dive into that.
Yeah.
We're also going to talk about that, in my opinion, the blurred line between cult and religion. Mm. So if that
there
phrase,
is one?
If that, if that phrase just makes kidding. You uncomfortable, then you should probably just stop listening.
It's going to be like the angel discussion. Yeah. So if you
and
gotta,
Lisa's downstairs,
yeah,
so she can't fucking stop
she
us.
Can't, she's not up here. So.
Anyway, all right. Southern California, 1920s. When we think of cults, we think of, Los Angeles, Southern California. Some of the most famous have called California home. Children of God, Heaven's Gate, the People's Temple, the Manson family. You kind of skewed around this a little bit.
Scientology. The only one we're going to dig into in this season is going to be, well, except except for our next episode, is going to be the Manson family because they are so closely connected to show business.
Sure.
I mean, the other ones, yes and no, Scientology. Definitely a cult.
Can we get put on the suppressive persons list?
I hope so.
That would be amazing.
I hope so.
I'll say if you do want to learn more about those other cults, there are great podcasts out there. And if you like funny things, the last podcast pretty much has episodes on all of the last podcast on the list has.
Well, I also wrote a book called Taking Up Serpents.
You did, and I actually lost that in the divorce. I realized that the other day because I was doing research and I was like, "Where's that book?" And I was like, "Oh, that chick." Anyway, cults badly want to coerce followers into giving them money and or sex, because, you know, who wouldn't? Early Southern California offered them interesting ways to do this. You said basically rich people plus church free for the most part and celebrities.
Yeah.
So this is kind of like the perfect breeding ground for...
Because you had all these people who came out there because they were trying to escape from something back home. And so they end up in California where... You know, I mean, yes, there was Catholicism, forced Catholicism on the original inhabitants that were there. And so you
Showed up? Okay.
There were still all the missions and things there. But other than that, there really was no, I mean, New England, you think of these certain, you know, kind of puritanical type, you know, faiths and, you know, the Southern Baptists and, you know, the Bible Belt. But what do you got? California? Nothing.
Just so gold all laying these
people,
on the ground.
Yeah, all these people end up out there, and so, man, here comes trouble right behind them.
It's perfect. Yeah, you said L.A. and Hollywood become the new Sodom and Gomorrah, but this description backfires and draws way more people in. I mean, it's the same. It's a, you tell a kid not to do something, like they're gonna want to do it, and that's just kind of what happened. I like this this quote you said. You said this became a draw for people in the 1920s, that great period of excess, abandonment, and experimentation. This was the time of the quote lost generation of young adults who had been traumatized by the horrors of the Great War, who had become cynical about the values of their parents and grandparents, the people responsible for starting that terrible war in the first place. We just keep seeing history repeat itself, right?
Yeah, Vietnam, absolutely.
And you know, the wars after that. And so it just kind of seems very cyclical.
Yep, it is. It is.
We just have more technology.
We were talking about this in our last episodes. We were talking about how the Great War spawned the modern horror movement that we know of. Scott Poole wrote a great book on it called Wasteland. I highly recommend it to anybody. If you are interested in, you know, how the trauma of war creates fictional horrors. And then we talked about how World War II and the, you know, the uptick in the murders in LA and other places after the war, when you've got all these guys coming home with PTSD and they're literally murdering people.
They got really good at killing people.
Yeah, exactly. And how do you just shut that off?
I couldn't imagine.
The same thing happened after Vietnam. I mean, it's continued to happen. We've watched people come home with, you know, PTSD from all of these different wars and have, you know, and then, you know, the VA is inadequate to deal with that kind of thing. And people don't have the patience to want to deal with it. And they just slide between the cracks. And it's, I mean, and it's not just military guys coming home. I mean, there's a reason we have so many, you know, shootings. What, we've had like 62 mass shootings this year alone?
Yeah, at least.
And that's insane. It's the end of May. How does this even happen? Mm-hmm. You know, because our mental health organizations in this country can't deal with it. And plus, we're coming out of a pandemic where, you know, you couldn't go to the hospital with anything other than COVID because there was nothing, you can't be treated. I mean, there was no way to treat anybody. So, you know, we're going to be picking up the pieces from this for a while.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just, that's the way it's going to be. And I think that we've looked at this, like you said, these are cycles that we go through that we see over and over and over again, and it will be this way forever.
Yeah.
I mean, it's human nature. Nothing's ever going to change. I mean, that's just how it is.
Yeah.
It's unfortunate. I'd like to think that it could change, that things could be done, but who knows? You know, I guess we'll see. Hope for the future.
Yeah, we'll be dead by then. But hope, you know,
hope our kids do a better job of it than we have. So.
Oh, yeah. Best of luck, children. Yeah. So movie stars immerse themselves in the occult. You talk about hundreds of performers are more than passingly interested in necromancy, superstition, prognostication in general. Palmists, crystal gazers, trance mediums were also everywhere. And then even people like paying astrologers to notify them of, like, okay, you know, if Mercury's in retrograde, let me know because that might affect this, you know, audition I have or something.
Still going on, too.
Of course it is, But I love the memes that talk about it. It's like, well, I'm a bad driver because I'm a Capri Sun. And it's just like, okay, lady. Anyway, moving on to Dr. Lewis Brown, who's a religious scholar, and he said in 1929 that the world is filled with primitive minds, talking about why people could fall for things like cults and stuff. He estimated that there were approximately 400 cults active in Southern California in the late 1920s, with memberships numbering in the hundreds of thousands. I never would have thought it was this widespread,
well,
that many people.
A lot. I mean, I list quite a few.
You do. Yeah. A couple I wanted to highlight. A Christian School of Psychosophy.
Yeah,
Yeah.
Psychosophy.
I was like, wait,
I know.
It's a typo.
I know. And it's not a typo.
And yeah. Church Invisible both sound really dope. Like, I like both of those. And I actually have some fun stuff about cult names
in
the next episode.
I'm still trying to figure out the Tabernacle of the Third Coming. I don't.
Yeah, yeah.
Didn't we skip one somewhere? But whatever.
You know, just wait till next episode. Have some fun stuff about names. So basically, there were a ton of cults. And you said, quote, there were once so many cults in the city that a 1930 newspaper editorial complained that, quote, Los Angeles extends a welcome asylum to every cult of every kind that seeks to hide temporarily its ugly head until it can build sufficient strength to begin spreading of its poisonous propaganda. So let's talk about these different types of cults that you've listed out, because I mean, God, cults are amazing, and I love how you broke them down by like genre, flavor.
Yeah,
I don't
mean,
know.
Like, that's the best way to handle it.
Yeah, it's perfect. So we're going to start with love cults. You talk about this Nest of Love on Santee Street, where women were forced to, quote, speak in tongues, perform devil dances, and engage in soul mating and spiritual husbands. This sounds kind of hot. I'm not going to lie. Like, this sounds pretty cool, right? And there's some.
Well, it's, you know, it's just these are excuses that people use to do whatever they want to do. And
right.
So you can say it's, you know, you're doing it. You can do anything in the name of religion in it.
Yeah, that's
you
true.
Know, it becomes okay.
Right.
And especially in this country where, you know, that's where freedom of religion will often backfire on people. They're, you know, become so afraid of violating people's, you know, freedom of religion rights that we end up with, you know, polygamists and guys married to 312-year-old girls and they call it their religion. And here we go. This is where we get into trouble. And I mean, some of this stuff is crazy, but I mean, largely harmless.
Sure.
For the most part. I mean, as far as we know.
It also helps, though. It helps take down the Ten Commandments at a federal building because they don't want Baphomet
right next
to it, you know?
I
do love some of that shit. But so there's something, we're going to dive into this a little bit more later, but there's something about female cult leaders, too, that's especially intriguing to me.
Well, again, it's the same reason that you had so many female leaders in the spiritualist movement in the 19th century, because especially at that time, even more so than, say, the 1920s, that was a time period where women were just utterly oppressed.
Yeah.
I mean, they were considered property of their husbands. They couldn't do anything without his permission. They couldn't open a bank account. They couldn't do anything. Well, suddenly now you've got all these women who are, you know, being blessed with these psychic gifts, you know, or of whatever kind. And now they're making their own money. They're leading an entire movement that is popular across the country. And this is the same kind of thing. So the 1920s comes around, and women are, for the first time, getting out. Now they have the vote. They can get out. They're starting to become, you know, at least, you know, semi-equal citizens with the men who've been, you know, keeping them down for centuries now. And so, you know, if they want to start a cult, more power to them.
Fucking right.
You know,
you talk about this in American Hauntings, too, the book a little bit, right? Like,
I talk about a lot about that because it's, I mean, it was a real change in our society that was needed. It's just odd that we have to do it in such an extreme way. It's the only way it seems to work.
I feel like the pendulum's got to swing real hard
and,
the other way.
By the 70s, you know, women are, you know, burning their bras and women's lib and all that. Which again is an extreme reaction, but that's what it took, and that's what it takes. And it's just like now, you know, we've got a female vice president, you know, and but it took a lot to get to that point, you know. So I don't know, you know, it's I think but that does explain a lot of these, you know, female cult leaders.
Yeah, well, they're just
but you know that changes though. That's a big thing in the 20s, and even the 30s. But by the time we get to the 60s and 70s, we flipped everything back again. Mm-hmm. And now you got Charlie Manson and all these other people that are now back to oppressing women again.
Right.
So it's all just, it all comes in cycles. Just
well,
like
I'm hoping that I'm on the upside of this other cycle and we get some more female cult leaders around at this time while I'm alive and in my prime, because that'd be great. Okay.
The ones that we get now are not anything you'd be interested in, trust me.
Oh, boy. So. All right. Just always breaking my heart. Well, let's talk about some of these love cults. So we have Helios. Is that correct? Mm-hmm. So this sounds like a name that was in like 300 or like a Greek or something.
It does.
Something.
I think it is a Greek name.
And I'm sure some asshole's going to be like, well, it's actually the god. Please tell me. I'm sorry I didn't research this.
I didn't either.
It's run by Edith Lessing, who preached that free love would replace marriage, presided over a ramshackle compound of tents and shacks and glass out part. Hey, you know what? All the more power to you, Edith. Temple of Thelma, so 1939, High Priestess Regina Cool. Is that how you pronounce it?
I think so, yes.
Okay. Again, I haven't listened to Troy's recordings yet. I've only read them. Set up the, quote, Temple of Thelma in a basement of one of the dorms at L.A. City College, so she would don robes, chant suggestive passages from an Aleister Crowley book, and embrace the power of the lifted lance. This is awesome. fucking dudes in a basement dorm, right?
Exactly. And it's calling it a church.
Because
that's what she wanted to do. So,
I mean,
whatever.
Hell, you know, as long as everybody's an adult and they're consenting, who cares? 1946, Henry King Daddy Newsom arrested.
On the other hand, is not.
Arrested for an underage sex camp, basically.
He's not funny.
Yeah, that's not cool. I won't even make any jokes about that. This one is interesting. I wanted to ask you some questions. So Guy Ballard, so there was an movement.
There's actually a really long history behind this.
Yeah.
And it is still active today.
So over a million devotees. This seems different.
Yeah, it was a little bigger.
You called it a movement.
Yeah,
even.
It was a little bigger than just a random cult. I mean, obviously, it's a cult.
Right.
I mean, he claimed that he, you know, made contact with this mysterious being on Mount Shasta, which is, there's a whole long history behind Mount Shasta. Colin Dickey, who wrote Ghostland, he also did a book called The Unidentified that came out last year, and he has a whole chapter about Mount Shasta. It's so crazy.
Okay.
I mean, everything from UFO bases to Bigfoot to everything, all this mystical
stuff.
Hot spot. And he talks quite a bit about Guy and Edna Ballard in the book and their movement that they created. And there, like I said, there are still remnants of it around today, because it became almost like a Rosicrucian kind of deal, you know, where it's still a fringe thing, but it became more mainstream than a lot of this other stuff did. I mean, you know, most of these that I'm talking about were very small, you know, within, you know, 50 to 100 people at the most. But this one actually got quite a bit
million.
Bigger. Yeah. And, you know, a few of the other ones we'll talk about here did too.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, this I called this one out just because I'd never heard of it.
Yeah.
But it seemed huge.
Yeah, it is. And it was all kind of a lot of UFO type stuff and mystical beings and, you know, a lot of Scientology-esque type stuff.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
So in other words, just complete, you know, made up.
Right.
You know,
yeah. No, I'm waiting for them to classify CrossFit as a cult and put them on some watch list. Next up,
can we put vegans on there too? I'm just kidding. Just kidding.
And atheists. Yeah. Those three groups. House of Judah. So House of Judah cult used purification by fire and, quote, Garden of Eden orgies, which sounds great on the surface.
Just sounds naked.
Yeah.
So.
Right. So members prayed and chanted together in the nude, sacrificed lambs, which they burned alive, much to the horror of their neighbors. So I mean, maybe try not to draw too much attention to yourself if you can, if you're trying to keep something underground.
Bad plan.
Yeah, and also, you know, don't burn lambs alive. Then we have Bishop Wilbur Leroy Cosper, arrested in 1926 for practicing medicine and religion without a license. They promised onlookers a resurrection day. So that's one of the common tropes. This episode, the next one, we're going to talk about common tropes. One of the big things with cults seems to be some end date.
You know? Well, and that's something that I talk a lot about in Taking Up Serpents.
Uh-huh.
I talk a lot about that there are lots and lots of cults with a prophet at the head who predicts days when the world's going to end. And then when they don't end, because
They move the goalpost.
Yeah, they just move the date and say that they misread it or they got another message from God and changed
sure.
it. And the other thing is the fascination that all of these cults seem to have with the Book of Revelation.
Yeah.
Which is the biggest bunch of mumbo jumbo gibberish.
Uh-huh.
And is not meant to be taken in any way literally.
How
and that's,
could it be?
But that's the problem.
Yeah.
Because well, yeah. since it's not meant to be taken literally, you can make up anything you want to about it. And that's your interpretation then. And that's where a lot of the trouble comes from.
Sure.
You know, and so people get suckered into these, you know, these cults and these movements because this guy seems to know what he's talking about.
Yeah.
You know, and that's the scary thing. That's the dangerous part of it.
Right. You know? Well, you heard it here first. There are problematic books in the Bible.
Well, yeah, right?
okay, no, that is interesting. Let's moving on to Seventh-day Adventists, not to be confused with what, Seventh-day Adventist?
Church. I know this is the mission.
This is right. the mission. This is Margaret Rowan. She's adamant that the world will end on February 6th, 1925.
Well, go ahead.
No,
and
no.
I'll tell you. I'll explain this Seventh-day thing.
No, sure. So honestly, that's the only note I had.
Oh, okay. Well,
so yeah, what do you
the
got?
The Seventh-day Adventist thing got its start way, way back in the 1840s.
Yeah, I don't know too much about it.
Yeah, it's it started with a cult run by a guy named William Miller. And they were the Millerites, and they were waiting for he had these dates. He spent like 7 or 8 years doing nothing but interpreting the Bible to what he believed was a secret code
okay.
inside that gave the date that of the second coming that
uh-huh.
was going to happen between like October 1843 and 1844, sometime in
okay,
there.
Okay, well, he narrowed it down
as the date got closer and closer. Members, and it was huge. It became a huge movement.
Yeah.
And members were, you know, giving up their jobs, their homes, their money, because they thought, this is it. You know, this is the day. It's going to happen.
Let's party.
And then it came and went.
Uh-huh.
And then it became known as the Great Disappointment. But, of course, he then tried to reconfigure things, but he lost a lot of his spark. But the thing was, is that then his thing that he dreamed up became a very standard part of mainstream churches.
Okay.
The Seventh-day Adventist Church spawned off of the Millerites.
Mm-hmm.
And then they are still exist, but, and they are, I mean, I guess you, I don't know if you would call them a cult, but you would call them maybe a fringe denomination, so
sure.
to speak. I mean, I would lump Jehovah's Witnesses and some of that kind of stuff in that same kind of fringy type thing.
Sure.
But his belief in the day of the second coming, which is only mentioned like once or twice in the entire Bible,
right.
but has become the staple for just about every denomination in this country.
Mm-hmm.
And it all came from William Miller. I traced the whole thing in Taking Up Serpents. I actually traced the founding of his cult all the way and how it seeped into mainstream churches.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's a standard thing. And I also have like an entire chapter devoted to all of these mainstream ministers, many, many, many of whom you've heard of,
mm-hmm.
Who came up with dates that the world was going to end
yeah.
or the second coming or whatever. And needless to say, all of them were wrong as
right.
we still sit here. You know. So yeah, it's become one of those things like the Antichrist, where most of the lore comes out of popular culture rather than from the actual Bible. You know, I mean,
who has time to read it? It's
well,
so
I know,
long.
And that's the problem. It's just kind of like, you know, all of these churches today, that these evangelical churches that all talk about how strict Christians they are, and yet they somehow have missed out on everything that, like, Jesus taught in the Bible.
Yeah.
All of that gets left out because we're supposed to be feeding the poor, welcoming immigrants, and all these things.
Be nice to each other.
Things that Jesus specifically said.
Yeah.
But they focus on things that aren't in the Bible at all.
Right.
So I don't, yeah, it's just, it's crazy. It's like, my thing is you got to have it one way or the other. You're either going to do it or not do it.
Be consistent at least.
So if you're going to say that I am this, and I'm going to practice this, well, then do it.
Yeah.
And you can't keep, you know, except for, mm-hmm. you know, it doesn't work that way.
Yeah,
you
asterisk.
Know? Yeah, right. I mean, you have to, if that's what you're going to follow, then that's what you need to follow.
Yeah.
If you're not going to, then say that. then don't do it.
Own up.
But don't act like you are. Don't, you know, don't be a, you know, a mega church driving Maseratis and all this stuff, because I'm pretty sure that there was some things that Jesus said in the Bible that specifically say you're not supposed to be driving sports cars and living in $500,000 houses if
having
you're a minister.
Yeah.
I think he kicked all those people out of the temple, if I remember correctly.
Right.
You know,
we
so,
don't talk about that story.
Yeah, well, see, yeah, I know, but that's my thing. You know, I mean, this is you know, this crazy radical is exactly what he was, you know, and, you know, that somehow that's become the wrong thing to be. It's
sure.
just crazy. I mean, and it's just, you know, religion is a tricky subject.
Yeah.
And I don't tell people what to believe or what not to believe. I think people probably, after listening to me for the last 5 years or whatever we've been doing this, or if you've read any of my books, you know that I have a somewhat jaded idea about many jaded ideas.
I would say
skeptical ideas about organized religion, but that doesn't mean that I don't believe in something. It's just really none of your business what it is.
Sure.
Because it's my, I can keep that private if I want to.
Of course.
But on the other hand, if you're doing crazy things and they're hurting people, that's not a good religion to be in.
Yep. And so, and I've talked about this since the beginning of the podcast. You know, if you if you want to believe in this or that, that's fine. But when I find someone that's believing in something and getting taken advantage of or using that to take advantage of people, that is where I'm going to call them out.
Sure.
And I'll use this podcast to express my opinions and be like, hey, you know, quit doing this shit to good people, and we're going to call them out then. So I know people don't care when we share opinions on this podcast, which is
right,
weird because it's our podcast, but we
it's
try.
Okay.
But if people are getting taken advantage of, we're going to call it out. Anyway, I know moving on to wacky cults. So this should just get even better. This is what I've called wacky cults. Let's talk about Mankind United, which sounds like a football team.
Yeah. Right.
You know what I mean? It was created by
next door to Manchester.
Yeah, by a sci-fi writer, Arthur Bell. He wrote a terrible book, but just to clarify, this book wasn't sci-fi, right? The one you were referencing?
No, it was supposed to be real.
Okay.
But
this wasn't one of the sci-fi ones.
He was a sci-fi writer.
So this,
he was writing for pulp magazines. Well, doesn't that sound familiar?
It does.
I mean, this is literally the story of Scientology, except it just didn't have any celebrities.
It's L. Ron Hubbard before it was out, because they also get the church incorporated so they can you know, okay, so yeah, so this is definitely like the predecessor for that.
Mm-hmm.
And he's living off all the money that he made from his followers while they kind of slaved away.
Right.
This next one, Aetherius, is that how you pronounce
it?
It sounds like another Greek or Roman name, I would imagine.
Yeah, it kind of does.
And somebody, again, call me an asshole on Twitter, but tell me because I don't know. 1950s, George King claimed an alien spoke to him, showed him transmissions from an all-star cosmic team that included Jesus and Buddha. I love that. This next one, is it Nigh Science? Nascience? How do you?
I think it's Nigh Science.
Okay.
That's the best I could come up with.
Okay.
Because it's the only... I didn't see anywhere the pronunciation.
Fair. I can't believe they didn't have it spelled.
Yeah, right?
Henry Colton blended Christianity with metaphysics and dream analysis. This actually sounds kind of fun. 1966, built a compound in Glendale. You notice that compounds tend to be a typical thing, too. Once you hit a certain level, you got to keep everybody contained and around.
So
you
that
can tell them the message.
Keep them under control.
Exactly. Yeah. Claimed to have once been a maiden in Atlantis. I like this folklore. That's fun. She dies in 1984. Her husband and co-founder hanged himself in 1991. This next one's called The Source. So Father Yad's tribal community, 100 white-robed seekers who moved into a Los Feliz mansion in 1972. Some of them jammed with him and his rock band Yo-Ho-Wa 13.
Yeah,
is that correct?
I mean, that was a pretty standard thing in the early 70s.
It sounds fun.
I mean, it was a way to... I mean, it's a... You know, I mean, I'm sure that they got the idea from Manson kind of thing.
Let's just get high, play music, and hang out in a big house together.
Yeah.
But again, cops called him part guru, part father, part pimp. So, doesn't sound like the best guy. Dies in a hand gliding accident in 1975.
Yeah.
Sounds kind of fun. You know,
sure.
Had he not had the pimp part, I think it would just been like a good party, you know, in Southern California back then. Now we're going to move on to some what I've called sinister cults. Things started to get dark in Hollywood in the 1960s. There's a surge of interest in the occult, especially after Rosemary's Baby. You said, quote, there had been devil-worshipping cults in California long before Anton LaVey founded the Church of Satan in California in 1969, which doesn't actually worship Satan, and we won't go into that, but it doesn't. But sinister cults had already been around in Hollywood for a while. And we know this because there were some cults, obviously, but also some not high profile murders, but some murders that stuck out.
Right.
So
right.
Macario Timon, or is it?
Yeah,
Timon?
I think that's right. Yeah.
Timon and Pumbaa. Yeah. Murdered in Oakland in 1926. Police find books and manuals on the occult and prayers signed in blood, beginning with "Most Powerful Lucifer." So this is like, we're going to get into this more, but it's like stereotypical what you want to think of cults in Hollywood. Type stuff.
Yeah.
There's more cults. The Hickory Hall priestess, Mrs. Leach, dominated the household mentally and physically. We have no wills of our own, no thought except hers, and beat children and cult members alike. Again, something about, you know, the female cult leader when they have some kind of mansion and, you know, control people. We're seeing a lot of these common themes and tropes. This is one we're going to talk about a little bit more extensively. This is the Process Church of the Final Judgment. Which is just such a, you put it into a computer and it comes back out as like cult name and just comes out the other end.
Exactly.
It began to flourish in the 1960s and 70s. The founders were an Englishman, Robert Moore, a.k.a. De Grimston?
Yeah, Robert De Grimston.
Okay.
I think he thought that sounded witchy, I guess.
So dumb. So. And then, this is cool, though, and Mary Ann MacLean, a.k.a. The Oracle, which is cool. Like, The Oracle's dope, right? This is before The Matrix and stuff, so Oracle's cool. Began as a splinter cult group from Scientology, and Moore and MacLean were declared suppressive persons. That's what it was. That's what I wanted us to get. I don't actually want to get on that list, but it'd be funny if we were. By L. Ron Hubbard in December 1965, kicked out of Scientology. Their peculiar theology stated that Jehovah, Christ, and Satan were not enemies, but they were equal parts of creation. This is, I mean, it's an interesting, fun idea. Yeah, they partied. Yeah. They were cool. Like most cults, they recruited teenagers and young people, separating them from their friends and family and indoctrinating them into groups. That's another big trope that we see, right? Like, you talk about separating people, cutting them off from their families.
Right.
I guess just to, like, get rid of any kind of voice of reason.
Anybody that's going to talk them out of being in the cult. I mean, that's essentially, say, like what Jim Jones did by shipping all those people off to Guyana,
right,
was to keep them in the cult, you know, and to make sure that they were not being led astray by people who were not family members or friends or whatever.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, how that ended up turning out.
I feel like if an organization that you are a part of has, like, specific lines and things that they tell you to rehearse when your family members are concerned about you, that's when you should throw up a red flag.
Right.
You know, QAnon. We won't go on about this, but that should be a red flag. So let's see. So probably not linked to Charles Manson. We'll talk about this later. Can you tell me a little bit more about this?
It's a long story.
Is? Okay.
There's a book that came out in the late 80s. And you remember, that was the era of the Satanic Panic.
Yes.
And this guy, Maury Terry, tried to link everything from the Process Church to the 4P movement and a few other things, and tried to link them from Manson all the way to Son of Sam. And it was this underground satanic network.
Uh-huh.
He is notoriously on that Geraldo Rivera special about, you know, Satanists everywhere across the country.
The ultimate evil.
Yeah,
okay.
Kidnapping. And so then I see the other day that there's a new documentary about I thought it was about Son of Sam murders.
Oh, on Netflix?
Sons of Sam, and this is what it's about.
Oh, no shit.
And,
I didn't even check it out yet.
And I haven't either, because that's when I found out that's what it was about. I thought, well, you know, and like I've said on the show before, you can say anything you want to in a documentary. That's why I have spent so much time trying to explain to people that there's no way H.H. Holmes was Jack the Ripper. I mean, he was in Chicago during the murders, but they don't want to hear it because they saw it on TV. And so that's the thing. You got to remember, documentaries are very skewed. It's like the Amelia Earhart photo, you know, the one that everybody saw on TV, that she was sitting on a dock in Japan. She'd been kidnapped. That picture was taken years before she even disappeared, you know, and it's just, but they saw it on TV and nobody corrects it. And this is the same kind of thing. So if you watch that documentary, don't start thinking that this is accurate, because it's not.
That's fair enough. And I've only heard people in our group, honestly, not like that documentary so far. I haven't heard anything positive about it. All right, so moving on. So this is the group I've deemed the Holy Rollers. Dust Bowl drives the Okies to California, essentially. This caused a new wave of churches, cults, and sects, a lot of them bringing racism and white supremacy to the masses.
Because a lot of them come out of
the
South.
Right.
You know, they come out of the South. They come from, you know, the Great Plains, where they just, there weren't any alternate people of color of any kind.
Sure. Well, they just had slaves years before.
Yeah. And so now you've got, you know, you're living in Oklahoma where, you know, that's where the Dust Bowl began. So Okies is where it got its name.
Right, right, right.
And so, but I mean, you know, it's a largely a white area and that's, you know, people come out to California and then there you go. And so, but you had people who fed into that, mm-hmm. like Bob Shuler.
Yep.
You know,
yeah,
who,
yeah.
you know, but it was also the 1920s, which was the rise of the new Ku Klux Klan was mm-hmm. in the 1920s. It was an era where, you know, following Griffith's Birth of a Nation film, mm-hmm. which portrayed the Klan as heroes in the movie, that's the reason they saw a resurgence in popularity is because of that movie. And so it was a case of, you know, again, pop culture influencing American history. And, you know, they, you know, soared to popularity for a few years anyway. And then, of course, they, you know, burned themselves down as they always do. So
sure. Well,
eventually they always do.
Yeah. Now they're completely gone. Everything's fine.
Well, now they're in government, but still.
Oh, I was going to say they're wearing different
eventually
uniforms.
Eventually they will burn themselves down.
Hopefully. Yeah,
they will.
You know, now at least you know who you're living next door to. Anyway, Bob Shuler takes over a failing Methodist church, starts blaming everyone else aside from his congregation for the way their lives are, gets his own radio station as a gift, because that's a normal thing, becomes America's essentially first broadcast evangelist, mm-hmm. but he goes too far, attacking LA city officials. Even use the term fake news. he eventually gets to say pretty much whatever he wants because a congregation member, John Porter, becomes mayor. But eventually, William Randolph Hearst gets involved. And I love this. Like, he's such an asshole, but he's finally just like, you know what? He does one good thing.
I can't take this
just
guy
take
anymore.
Down. This guy spends $1 million to pretty much destroy his ministry.
Yeah.
So, you know, it doesn't make up for all the other terrible things, but thanks, you know, Hearst. We're getting toward the end here. So, Amy Simple McPherson, a.k.a. Sister Amy, the International Church of Foursquare Gospel.
Which is still around.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so
Foursquare churches are still around.
She started it. After two husbands, she feels she's meant for something bigger. So with nothing more than $100 and a tambourine, as she liked to say, drives to L.A. With her family. By 1923, had her own Angelus Temple where she did like weird sketches, essentially.
It's hard to explain.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
So like she vaudeville? Started, well, essentially, yeah, in a way. Actually, the best way to describe what Amy was doing was she was a mega church before mega churches existed.
Sure.
You know how we kind of laugh about these churches with coffee shops and all that stuff in them? That was the Angelus Temple. That was Amy. She would put on these huge shows, these big pageants that she would star in, and she would sing, and she incorporated like popular music and changed the words and made him more religious.
Okay.
And I mean, that was her stick.
It's pretty smart.
And it sucked people in. And I'm not saying that, you know, I think it was done with the best of intentions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I just think she also had a lot of people around her, especially her mother. You got to read Taking Up Serpents. I do a whole big thing.
I need to just buy another
Sister
copy
Amy,
at this point.
Because I find the story fascinating. And when they did that reboot of Perry Mason, mm-hmm. a year or so ago, they had a character very similar to this in it.
Okay.
And she was based on Sister Amy. They also had, when they did the Penny Dreadful, The City of Angels, mm-hmm. they also had a character like Sister Amy
too.
So I think that, again, like I said, I think that she did a lot of what she did with the best of intentions. But, I mean, she was raking in huge amounts of cash. But, you know, she was human. And so I don't really laugh at her downfall. I find it ironic because, I mean, this happens to all of them. I mean, look at how many we've seen even like in our lifetimes. I mean, Jimmy Swaggart and, you know, all these Jim Baker and all these people who, you know, who get taken down.
Just fingers crossed for Joel Osteen over here.
Well, but the thing about Amy is that she wasn't targeting other people like these a lot of these people do.
Yeah.
And so you kind of look at him and you go, well, you deserve it because you were such a horrible person.
Right.
She really was just trying to spread the word, you
then,
know?
Then
I
why
mean,
do this dumbass disappearance
I don't
act?
Know. I don't know. That's a good question. And I wish that, you know, like I said, I just gave it an overview here and I went into a lot more detail in the book, but I just, I think that she needed a break. I mean, I think she needed to get away from this.
That's fair.
And this is the way, for whatever reason, thought this was a good idea. My guess is that she probably never intended on ever coming back.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess at some point she decided that she couldn't make it on her own and faked, you know, that she had been kidnapped and showed up in this town in Mexico and was in the hospital. But then, you know, the DA was going to land on her with both feet and then ended up doing it for the same reason I'm giving her a pass, because, you know, I think he probably felt sorry for her because her mother was a terror. And so I think that, you know, there were some extenuating circumstances here that I kind of feel sorry for.
Yeah.
But it's just such an interesting story. Sure. You know, it's a fascinating story that she became this pop culture icon in L.A. during this time period. I mean, movie stars and, I mean, everybody went to her performances because that's essentially what they were. I mean, they were church services, but there'd be like 5,000 people there.
Yeah.
And,
Sounds awesome.
People enjoyed it. You know, they felt like they were getting a bang for their buck. You know, people didn't feel used. They didn't feel like they were being taken advantage of, even though they probably in many ways were, because it was so much money coming in, just unbelievable amounts of money at a time when, you know, we're on the verge of, you know, a depression, but it was still the roaring 20s.
Sure.
So, you know, there was still money to go around. And I just think that, I don't know. I have a hard time. I had to include that story because she's just so iconic in LA.
Yeah.
And it needed to be talked about. But I do in a lot of ways do kind of feel sorry for her the way it ended up. Because I don't think she meant to. I think she really believed what she was doing was right.
Mm-hmm.
You know? I think she really believed she was healing people.
Yeah.
And I think she had a lot of people around her that were manipulating her.
Okay.
And manipulating her beliefs and manipulating, you know, what she thought was going on with a lot of things. It's a complicated story.
But okay, that's fair.
Anyway, but it is an interesting one, and I couldn't not include it.
No, that's fair. No, you know, just the fact that she wasn't fucking little kids, like I'm happy for her, right, like as a cult
exactly,
leader.
Yes.
So that's great.
Yes, hurting people.
What is Secanol?
My mind just went blank.
On the spot.
It's an anti-anxiety medicine of the time.
Okay.
Like a tranquilizer.
Oh.
Yeah, I want to say that Marilyn Monroe was on Secanol maybe too.
Probably.
And maybe that's what she died from.
I
can't remember.
I figured I could Google it, but I didn't know if you had something you wanted to talk about.
No, not really. It's just one of those drugs that you see pop up, you know,
around that time.
Mid-19th, you know, 20th century.
So it's rumored that she had a direct telephone line to the Angelus Temple, was buried with her in case she came back so she could hit up her followers and be like, hey, you know, I'm ready to rock and roll. Oh boy. All right. So that's going to end our part one of all these cults. So it is now time for our Ghostwriter segment. If you have a question or comment about the world of the macabre, you can email us at AmericanHauntingsPodcast@gmail.com. This first email comes to us from Kathy. It is titled, "Just Discovered Your Podcast. Awesome Sauce." It says, "Hello there, Troy and Cody. Just wanted to let you guys know that I recently found your podcast and I'm in love." And love is in all caps. What caught me is season 5 of the Los Angeles series. I grew up in San Diego and Los Angeles was always in our backyard, making frequent trips to the area like Hollywood, Disneyland, although in Orange County, and frequently visiting Santa Fe Springs for work. I have always been obsessed with old Hollywood, old movies, the unspoken truth and rumors of Hollywood's yesteryear. Your podcast is spot on, well-written and narrated. Sorry, I'm like squinting at that. I'm just getting so old. Thoroughly enjoying and digging into season 4 right now. Thank you for your talents. I look forward to many more episodes and seasons. Well, thank you, Kathy. That's very nice.
Yes.
And this other message that we got is from Tracy. It says, "I have a quick question. Have you guys ever thought about making American Hauntings dog collars and leashes? Because if you did and you had them, if you made them, I'd buy them for my dog."
Oh,
thanks,
you mean
Tracy.
For your dog?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Well,
threw
I don't,
me off. So
she does say for her dog. Okay. I won't kink shame anybody if they're not for the dog, but that's a good question. So basically, people ask me about different products and stuff all the time. At the moment, I'm pretty much limited by the services that we use as to what products we can make. But I've been looking into other things. Teespring's been one that Troy sent me a couple times, and we're looking into different ways to make different things. But if you guys have ideas for like shit you would buy or like you actually want, I mean, please send me an email, AmericanHauntingsPodcast@gmail.com. Hit me up on Twitter, Instagram, whatever. If there's something you want, let me know, and if I can make it happen easily, I will. Like, why not?
Sure.
And then I just wanted to give a couple shout outs to some of our new Patreon subscribers. So thank you very much for supporting the show, Robert, Sabrina, and Elise. We couldn't do what we do without all of you. So thank you so much for supporting the show and making it sound better than season one. Lisa's here with some high noons.
Hey.
That's all I got, dude.
All right. Well, sounds good. So anyway, guys, thanks for listening. Thanks for listening, letting me go off on a couple of tangents there.
Just you wait.
Stuff, but yeah.
Sorry,
so, but anyway, thanks for tuning in again.
Troy cried, Lisa.
Do leave us some reviews. I know Cody said that he doesn't care, but it does. Well, yeah, but people are able to find the show if we leave reviews.
I know.
So
please leave reviews.
So please do that. If for no other reason, at least do that for us. So. Anyway, I guess that's it for me. And since I'm not going to do any clips from Orson Welles this week, can we just not do the ending?
Yeah, we're just going to end the show by saying that this episode of the American Hauntings Podcast is written by Troy Taylor and is produced and edited by me, Cody Beck.
Orson Welles.
If you're not a regular listener of the podcast, we hope you'll check it out on a bi-weekly dose of history, hauntings, legends, lore, and the dark side of American history. You can find and subscribe to the show on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, or anywhere you listen to your favorite shows. See the website at AmericanHauntingsPodcast.com for more info about the show, notes, photos, links, and more.
Because the Wi-Fi is
If you are a regular listener, we hope you'll take the time to review us on the Apple Podcast app and share the show with your friends, neighbors, relatives, people you pass on the street, whomever we couldn't and wouldn't do the show without you. If you're a fan, then you also know that American Hauntings is not just the podcast. It's books, tours, events, Troy's comedy albums, and more. And our main website is AmericanHauntings.net.
We will record no podcasts before their time.
Those of you who write to us and tell us you wish we posted shows more often, well, you can have fresh content if you support the show on Patreon. That's not the only perk that you'll get either. There are discounts, shirts,
Orson Welles impressions.
Stuff in the mail, all kinds of things. For those who don't understand how important our Patreon is to us, go back and listen to the first season of the show. Yeah, that's right. Patreon is what made it all get better. It wasn't my blood, sweat, and tears. So check it all out at patreon.com/AmericanHauntings. And if you have any comments about the show, suggestions, reviews, jokes, or just want to tell us what you really think of us, God damn it. We're reachable via email, on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook messages, and a bottle carrier pigeon and Telegram. Gonna sit in this. I hope this gets taken down by some weird copyright shit. DCMA.
It won't.
Until next time. I won't sign off until it's time. Until next time. Goodbye. So long. See you later. We're gonna get sued by Orson Welles lawyers. You're gonna have to
Orson Welles lawyers. Yeah. Probably.